David Krell, who will be on with us next week, couldn't spit it out, because the book is about sports in a very real sense, but the book is also about America at a time when the sports landscape was really beginning a major change. And just to reiterate, we talked on the last time about up through about 1967. The book revolves around Carmen Coase's Yale football teams from the late 60s, which included among its most, famous players would be Calvin Hill and Brian Dowling. They deserve to be famous, and especially Hill was probably one of the best players ever to come out of the Ivy League. Now, in 1968, Yale goes undefeated in football, and Reg will take you moment by moment, blow by blow, through that in a really compelling and interesting way. And when that season is over, it has really been for Yale a really cathartic thing. It's the first time they've beaten Dartmouth, Princeton, and Harvard all in one season, or at least in a long time. And at the time, Yale gets ranked as high as 16th in the nation.
Wow.
And it's because at that point in time, the Yale was playing by basically the same rules as all the big schools, minus the scholarships. But if you got enough money to give academic scholarships, and the Ivy League schools did, they could. Plus, people felt like, were less likely to say, you know, I'm going to go play a year and I'm going to become a pro. People went to college and appreciated that they could get a college education by being a football player. And these were smart kids. They were not, they may not all have had the same credentials as everybody at Yale, but they were bright kids. They deserved to be there. And that set up in a very important year in our history, a change. Kingman Brewster is starting to push for co-education at Yale, something that he wanted to merge with Vassar. Vassar didn't want to merge. It was something that the Ivies were just beginning to understand would be really important. Resistance to it, it'll hurt our sports teams. It won't be as good. Second resistance to it, if we just take girls based on their credentials, the girls are going to be smarter than the boys. And these were things we're running through, and the old guard alumni didn't want it. It's also a time of the Democratic National Convention where the Chicago police turn into the Gestapo and just start beating people at random. Bobby Kennedy and Martin Luther King are assassinated. It's a year in which there are all kinds of political dramas and upheavals and problems. And the Ivy League's not immune to that. We think of Ivy Tower, Ivy League, but they weren't immune to it, and their students were directly involved. What you learn that's really interesting is, as much as they wanted to beat each other, and they did, the lack of animosity was in part because of the pedigree of the players. Now, prior to Kingman Brewster coming to Yale, and this was something that when I was a senior in high school, this was a big topic. If you went to Exeter, Andover, St. Paul's, Choate, any of the top New England male prep schools, you had a way easier route to get to an Ivy League school than did other people, especially if you were a legacy. Now, my sister-in-law's aunt was for a while the director of admissions at Yale. And back when my son was applying to schools, said to me that they were trying to change the legacy format. That's a really tough thing to do, because if you tee off the really rich alums and they stop giving you money, you would think people wouldn't think that way. So it's at a time when I like to call the democratization of the Ivy League. Instead of being, I think it's where there's 70, 80% of the kids came from public schools, which would seem to me to be about the right percentage at least, right? I mean, it's not to say that students that went to Exeter and went to Northfield, Mount Hermon, and Deerfield, and those places weren't really smart. I mean, I knew those guys. I wasn't as smart as a lot of them were. But what Reg does so well is he weaves all this together into the same narrative, and then we'll finish up with the 69 season with the famous Harvard wins 29-29, where Harvard scored 16 points in the last 42 seconds, and Pete Varney, who I dislike because he went to Deerfield and we played against them, and he was a really good athlete and a very good guy, made a couple of spectacular catches. But you learn about this friendship between Calvin Hill and Brian Dowling, which is not unique, but not a common one. I mean, Calvin comes from modest circumstances in Baltimore. He's such a good athlete, he gets to go to the Riverdale Country Day School in New York, comes to Yale expecting to be the quarterback, and then there's Brian Dowling, and they move Calvin Hill to linebacker and third string fullback. He ends up being probably the greatest football player in Yale history, a triple threat. He had games where he ran for a touchdown, caught passes, and threw for touchdowns. He obviously a very bright guy, and their friendship has lasted forever. We don't have Doonesbury as a cartoon if we don't have this, right? Because a lot of people don't realize that the BD is Brian Dowling, who is fine with Trudeau. They're friends to this day. And Trudeau began that comic strip, and he began the comic strip with a slight political edge to it because that had also to do with what was going on. You add to all of this the fact that the Vietnam War is really starting to heat up. In some cases, thought there was going to be this going to be a big issue, and they got into those programs, 1 year programs for the Army, bridge between high school and college. There were people that were drafted out of Yale because they had reached the age where you could be drafted. There was this sense that the Ivies were losing some of their influence. But I'll tell you, when you read through this casual who's helping pull down the goalposts at Princeton, future President George W. Bush. You've got Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton showing up in here. Meryl Streep driving to go to the first co-ed day at Yale, co-ed weekend, where they had 700 women come.
Wow.
700 guys at Yale had to evacuate their dorms and bunk in with other guys to let it happen. Yale's playing their football game on the road. Meryl Streep's then boyfriend didn't know she was coming. When she ran into him, he was showing another woman where his room was so she could stay there. And I guess with some aplomb, he got out. He managed to get out of that. But there were a few things I really wanted to note here while we still got some time. It begins with this here. One more page. Excuse me. The problem is it's a manuscript. It's not like a book where it's easy to mark. But one of the people who listened to the famous game in 1969 is someone would be famous to people in Connecticut, John Downey. Now, John Downey was shot down by the Chinese and was in a Chinese prison for a long time, swapped out, CIA operative, later became a lawyer in Connecticut. And he was thousands of miles away in a prison cell. He had played, he was 38, he had played guard on the 49 and 50 Harvard teams and had gone to work for the CIA. He received a card from his friend in mid-December that read, "Jack, Yale undefeated, champions 29-13, because with 42 seconds to go, nobody thought the game was going to be tied up. And he would learn the truth much later in a second batch of mail. And there were many, many people who left the stadium believing, well, this is over. And, if you've ever been to Harvard Stadium or to Yale Bowl, you know, they're not easy places to get on Soldier Field Parkway there or whatever. But after the game, a tremendous number of Yale players stayed in Cambridge with friends who played on the football team because they had known each other for a long, long time. I just can't imagine Alabama Auburn players doing that. I don't see Michigan Ohio State doing that. This coeducation and the change into democratization will lead to the de-emphasis of football and will lead to the Ivy League not getting ranked in the top 20 again. But it's an era where I really have come to admire those athletes. I mean, I saw what the famous game with Dowling hooked up with Calvin Hill down the far sideline in 68 to win a big game. A friend of mine's father took us there. And I've seen a lot of Ivy League football games, mostly from when my son played at Lafayette. There is something still sort of mystical about being at the Yale Bowl or Harvard Stadium or Dartmouth. I went to a football game at Dartmouth when I was in prep school. That reminds you, they've been playing this game a long, long time. And it was only I think 10 years ago that Yale didn't have as many All-Americans as Michigan. It might have been a little longer ago than that. But they had the most number of them for the longest time because they've been playing it forever. But Blue Power is a really good book, and I didn't want to tip off a lot of the stuff that's in here. I want people to enjoy it when it comes out. But you will run through America in a million different ways in reading this book. It's 9 Goals was good, but as I would say to Reg, this is really good.
I'm looking forward to reading it there.
Yep.
My experience at the Yale Bowl is when Maine played there a few years ago now, 6-7 years ago, I think. And I felt like they had not made updates to the stadium probably since Brian Dowling was playing.
Oh, no.
Including the press box, which was awful.
It's an old, old stadium. I remember the year the New York Giants played there when the Yankee Stadium was under construction before they'd gone to the Meadowlands. And, it was it's an old stadium.
Yeah, it sure is. Next week on Sports Lit 101, David Krell returns.
Yeah, I'm really excited because his Yankee book is like his Fenway book, which he's been getting great reviews from and doing a lot of readings and stuff, the Fenway effect. He just knows how to pinpoint what matters, you know, and opens your eyes to a lot of things.
What's coming up next week on Sports Lit 101. Thank you, Bruce.
My pleasure is all.
We can see the weekend from here, and you know what that means on Retro Radio. Lots more great music. Casey Kasem, American Top 40, the 70s, Saturday morning at 10, Sunday night at 9. Rick Dees, weekly Top 40, the 80s, coming up Saturday night at 8 and Sunday at noon. And on our Saturday night music party, Retro Saturday Night. We're going back, hopping in the time machine and setting the dial back 50 years to feature the music that was on the radio in the spring, well, specifically the middle of May, back in 1974, which does not seem like 50 years ago to me, but that's a story for another day. There, but lots of great stuff. Music from folks like Jimmy Buffett, his first time on the charts 50 years ago. Carly Simon, Diana Ross, Marvin Gaye, Gordon Lightfoot, Cat Stevens, Stevie Wonder, The Stylistics, Chicago, Paul McCartney and Wings, Elton John, Three Dog Night, Grand Funk, and more. And special guests, Alan Clark of the Hollies. They were racing their way up the charts with The Air That I Breathe. And Terry Jacks, the man who gave us Seasons in the Sun. Great guy, too. Canadian guy and a huge hockey fan, as you might guess.
Yes.
But he's got a great story about the origins of Seasons in the Sun, a song that had been around for about 25 years when he tweaked it a little bit and turned it into the biggest hit of the spring of 74. All that on Retro Saturday Night, Saturday at 6 right here on Z62, your retro radio.
Hi, everybody. This is Russell Hitchcock with Air Supply, and you're listening to Downtown with Rich Kimball, not like the guy from The Fugitive.